Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. If attaining the American dream has become almost impossible for average middle-class Americans, imagine the struggles of those lower on the economic totem pole. And for many of those individuals, moving up the ladder has been next to impossible for a long time, particularly in Charlotte. A few years ago, a group of Harvard researchers told us that our city was 50th out of 50 in the ability of people born into poverty to move out of poverty. If you were born here, you would likely die poor here. If you were born poor here, you would likely die poor here. Well, we've been wringing our hands and searching for a way to change that ever since. Doing so encompasses changing racial attitudes, working on problems caused by segregation, addressing income inequality, increasing our stock of affordable housing, and increasing job opportunities. Each of those is a challenge in its own right. Taken collectively, that challenge becomes daunting. Well, the good news is that same group of Harvard researchers is now working on fixing the problem on the ground here in Charlotte and elsewhere, using the same data-informed, evidence-based approach that led to their original conclusions in that upward mobility study. One of those researchers is with us for the hour. David Williams is the policy director at Opportunity Insights, the research and public policy lab based at Harvard University, which is dedicated to using big data to improve upward mobility in America. He's also helping to lead the Charlotte Opportunity Initiative, a community-wide place-based movement aimed at improving economic opportunity throughout Charlotte and Mecklenburg County. And he joins us from the studios of WGBH in Boston. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Mm-hmm. And thank you for being here. Incidentally, he will be in Charlotte next Tuesday evening from 6 to 8 at the Halton Theater on the CPCC main campus for a Building Futures Symposium on Affordable Housing, and you can check our website for details. Let's start by going back. For those who have not lived here for a long time, it came as a great shock to Charlottians, and we were pretty embarrassed by it, actually, that we fared so badly in this so-called Chetty study at Harvard by Raj Chetty and Nathaniel Hendren and John Friedman. So we launched a task force that took over a year to come up with recommendations. Among them, increase the supply of affordable housing. And we've been working on this ever since. But solutions really seem pretty far away. Even the possibility that there might be a solution seemed iffy to many. So before we talk about solutions, let's talk about other cities on this list. We were 50th. Who came in at 45th, 46th, 47th? Who were they?
That's a great question. I do know. And so one of them is actually my hometown. So I was raised in Detroit, Michigan. And before starting at Opportunity Insights, I worked in the mayor's office. So worked for Mayor Dugging, working on similar issues, right? Thinking around economic development, affordable housing, land use policy, because Detroit, you know, is a city that looks very different than Charlotte, but is also dealing with massive problems. But unlike Charlotte, which is growing, and I think that 50 out of 50 number was a surprise, I think people in Detroit knew we were facing those problems. So the issues we were dealing with was actually thinking around, how do we rebuild the physical infrastructure of our city, right? It's a place that over the past 50 years, we lost over 1 million people, over half our population. But even over the past 15, 20 years, one in every three single-family homes was lost through tax foreclosure, right? So tens of thousands of families who were displaced. So we had to think around, you know, how do we use something like housing policy to help rebuild and stabilize our neighborhoods, right? How do we rebuild a great American city to really help advance upward mobility?
But it seems to me, I mean, Detroit came out ahead of us in this study, which is really alarming to a lot of people, because if you've never been to Detroit, you've seen it on television, and you've seen these block after block after block of downtown areas that are being plowed under because there's nobody to live in those houses. The problem in Detroit seems to be very different from the problem in Charlotte. We're an economic boom town. Detroit is going through economic problems because of industry moving out. I'm sure it hits the lower socioeconomic classes pretty much the same way, but with the solution even being close to being the same.
You know, that's a great point, and I think that's what is so interesting about the research that Raj and the team has done, because I think oftentimes, right, we look at what we can see, right? We look at these more surface level factors, right? In a place like Detroit, you can see the blight. You can see what's happened over the past 50 years. But I think in places like Charlotte, places like Atlanta and Dallas, cities that have been growing tremendously over the past 10, 20, and 30 years, right? Where you see jobs, you see new growth and development. But then what's the real impact for those low income and middle income families that are local? Right. And I think what we're seeing through conversations and through the data is that, yeah, those jobs at Bank of America, Wells Fargo, those jobs are fantastic. Right. They represent real opportunity, but generally for people who were moving to Charlotte. Right. Those folks who are growing up in the community. Right. They, it doesn't look like, seem to have access to that opportunity that's happening right in their own backyard. Right. So I think it can make us be much more thoughtful and critical around what really creates opportunity in our community, not just jobs, right? Those are important. Mm-hmm. Of course, economic prosperity, economic development is important. But how do we really connect those jobs and those opportunities to the families and to the kids in our communities who need it most?
You've also studied communities in which poverty is less of an impediment to upward mobility, and I'm sure those cities were at the top of that 50-city list. What made those cities so successful in helping people move up the ladder? Why? What are they doing differently?
Mm-hmm. So something that we do see that's pretty consistent is an issue like segregation, right? Cities and communities that are more integrated in terms of both race and economic income, those are places where we see better outcomes for low-income kids, right? And I think we see it both at the region level, but also within communities, right? Within neighborhoods, right? Places where there's a more healthy income mix, right? Places where you can see people that model pathways to college and to stable careers. Those seem to be places where those upward mobility rates are higher. And I think just the fact that Charlotte has acknowledged something like segregation and that history of discrimination, I think is an actually very powerful thing.
Since you were helping the mayor of Detroit before you came to Opportunity Insights, the organization at Harvard that both did this study and is now working to find solutions to the problem that this study pointed out, particularly in Charlotte for us, for our listeners, were there things that were happening in Detroit that you're now helping to apply here, or is it apples and oranges?
So very different issues, but I think something that's consistent is, one, it's part of it is the idea of patience and priorities, right? These are issues, these different rates of upward mobility are things that didn't happen overnight, right? They were a long time coming. They're, you know, coming from like long histories. And so we're not going to solve these problems overnight either. And I think that's part of what we did in Detroit was we need to think holistically around these problems, right? There's a limited amount of resources. So how do we invest them in the most thoughtful, impactful ways? Also knowing that, again, there are different steps we're going to have to take. We're not going to solve this overnight. We have to be thoughtful and strategic to make sure this change is actually sustainable. So in Detroit, a lot of the focus was, let's build on areas of strength, right? Let's invest in neighborhoods where there's a strong backbone, where there's strong community groups to help us really rebuild in a sustainable way. And then we can build from that once we start to regain the tax base, encourage people to move back into the city. Then we can reinvest that in all those social programs we know we need down the line. I think a place like Charlotte,
go ahead.
A place like Charlotte, you know, is already growing, right? That money, people are coming into the community, and it's more about how do we direct those resources in the most efficient and effective ways to make sure that those new resources actually help those most vulnerable within our community.
And you're using what is to some people a dirty word, because we've done shows on big data in the past and where that comes from and how it's collected and how it's being used for and against us. But you use big data to uncover obstacles and income inequalities and use that same approach to come up with policy changes at the local level that might help to remove those obstacles. Is this a new approach? It seems to me people have always made policy, one would hope, out of understanding a problem before they put forth a solution. And one of the ways to understand that is to collect information, data.
No, absolutely. So it's not new, because I think good policy usually is driven by good data and research. But what we have now are much larger data sets that could help us think about these issues in more granular ways. and being able to track outcomes more longitudinally, right? So looking at long-term outcomes. So I think what's so amazing about Raj and the team's research is, you know, we haven't been able to track outcomes across generations in this way before because of the access that we have to Census Bureau and IRS data. And you know, he often says, right, companies like Amazon, companies like Google, they've been using big data, different kinds of big data, for a very long time and effectively monetizing it. So why don't we do the same thing but for social good, right? Why don't we use these same kind of techniques to figure out how to have more effective policies for our communities?
I know you've broken down these data into an atlas that pretty much pinpoints, you can almost, with a computer, use these data sets to find out exactly micro things about individuals and areas and neighborhoods and city blocks and what's going on in those blocks, which you could only do with a computer. Can you explain that better to our listeners? Because I have a really rudimentary understanding of it.
Absolutely. So research from a couple years ago, and we call it the Opportunity Atlas, and we've turned it into an online tool, right? So it's all open source, and you can actually go on right now, opportunityatlas.org. It's basically a map that looks at opportunity across the country for every neighborhood in every region in every state. And so what we did was basically using anonymized IRS data and Census Bureau data of 20 million kids who were born and grew up in the 80s and early 90s. We know where they grew up. We know how much money their parents made when they were growing up. And we can track their outcomes into adulthood. So we know how much they earned when they were entering the job market. And so we can take that and look at basically the impact of every neighborhood across the country. And we know how those kids did. And it really gets at the causal impact of these places. And we can break it down by gender, by race, by how much money, again, their parents were making when they grew up. So it's really looking at mobility across the country.
How do you know that? People in this country move all the time. So how do you know that somebody living at my address makes what I made in 1975? How do you know that?
Oh, no, that's a great question. And so what it does is it looks at, so it doesn't necessarily look at kind of the rates that we show are based on where you grew up, regardless of where you move, right? So the mobility rates that we show for Charlotte, they're for kids who grew up in Charlotte, even if they moved to New York or Durham or LA, because we're really trying to get at the root of these issues. And we really see that the neighborhood where kids grow up, again, regardless of where they end up moving, really can have a transformative impact on those long-term outcomes.
So your ability to look at this data, to slice and dice it and manipulate it to answer key questions that you can formulate and use this data to answer, what does that allow you to do and policymakers to do that they couldn't do before?
So again, I think especially Charlotte is such a great example of this, because usually when we're looking at neighborhoods, we look at things like poverty rate, right? We look at the median income of these places, how they look at the surface level. But this really gets at the core issue, right? Not just how things appear, but the real impact they have in the long term, which oftentimes we can't see without being able to track these outcomes across time. So I think it really brings more nuance to the conversation, not just places that look poor or look rich or look good or look bad, but places that might be surprising, right? Places where we might assume it's a more working class neighborhood, but actually the kids who grew up there have really great outcomes, right? So what's happening locally that might be hard to see on the surface that might be driving these really good outcomes?
And I would assume this allows you to see obstacles that perhaps you may have assumed were there before, but now you can identify those obstacles as actually having been there before, or maybe not. Maybe you assumed they were there, but they weren't. But if you see them, you can then work to remove them, which we'll talk about as we go through this program. David Williams is with us. He's the Policy Director of Opportunity Insights at Harvard University and one of the leads of the Charlotte Opportunity Initiative. And we're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about upward mobility and solutions to a problem that Charlotte found out, much to its chagrin, several years ago, thanks to Harvard researchers. And those same researchers are now working on helping the city find solutions. David Williams is one of the people who works there. He's the policy director of Opportunity Insights at Harvard University. One thing that we all share is a statistic that you presented recently to Charlotte City Council. We all know that one aspect of the American dream is that a person, you know, people want their children to be better off than they were. And in 1940, that expectation was a reality for a lot of people. But I saw this graph that you presented to City Council, and it's shocking. Ever since 1940, the percent of children earning more than their parents has been on the decline since 1940, which I think explains a lot about the unrest in the country and about our politics. It certainly explains the plight of those in poverty. Why has this been happening?
That's a great question, and that's what we try and get at with the research. So one, of course, our country has changed dramatically since the 1940s, right? Economic growth looks a bit different, but we see is that inequality is a real thing, right? And it manifests in those numbers. Because like you said, I mean, not only did many people have high rates of immobility in the 1940s, but it was almost a guarantee, right? Over 90% of kids or people born in the 1940s grew up to earn more than their parents. Whereas for folks today, folks who are entering the job market now who were born in the 80s, that guarantee has become a coin flip, right? It's a 50-50 shot whether or not you will grow up to earn more than your parents. And that I think really questions some of these assumptions that we have around what the American dream is, and is it still alive here?
Let me ask a question about that, because earning is not the only indicator. I mean, you can earn less than your parents as long as things don't cost as much as they did when your parents were around. Is the other side of that equation being balanced at all? Are things, if you did a graph since 1940, would things cost less today than they did then on average?
This isn't my exact wheelhouse of expertise, but it's pretty clear that I think wages have not kept up with the same rates. Okay. Right? I think in the 70s and 80s, when you see those wages stagnate, and you see it represented today, right, with eviction rates, people paying more for rent, paying more for food. I think when you see these earnings changes and people not being able to keep up with costs, I think that kind of compounds that same frustration that we see.
We've heard anecdotal conversations about, we've had them on this program about how people's wages aren't rising and the average worker hasn't had a raise since 1970-something. And but you see this graph that you presented to City Council, and it is dramatic because it is a straight diagonal line to the bottom from the 1940 heights. Have we been like the frog in a pot of boiling water just now recognizing this long-term trend, or have policymakers and planners been aware of it and just ignoring it or not knowing what to do about it?
I think it's all the above.
Okay.
And I think that Charlotte is a great example of this, right? So I think you have places like the Rust Belt. You have places like Detroit and Cleveland who I'm pretty sure folks were aware of the issues that we were facing there. But, right, you have places that have been growing, right? You have places in the Sun Belt where those issues look really different. And I think we're just now starting to really get a grasp on how these issues of mobility are starting to really affect our communities.
So you've mentioned, and I mentioned in the beginning, that one of the problems here is segregation. It's one of those obstacles we've been talking about for a long time. And when you talk about this, in terms of finding solutions to the problems that Charlotte and other cities face, are you talking about the segregation from the early 20th century, due to Jim Crow and redlining and things like that? Or are we talking about the self-segregation that we have in so many cities, including Charlotte today?
So that's a really important question because, right, redlining, housing discrimination, they helped shape our cities, right? That's why you have a lot of communities that are communities of color that have been disinvested in for decades, and you have a lot of much whiter, much more affluent communities. And you see disparities in outcomes based on some of those differences. But I think, you know, a lot of the conversation is we had those historical inequities, but, you know, is it self-segregation, right? Are families now choosing to live where they live because, right, that's where they're more comfortable? And so, you know, part of our work as a research group is to actually interrogate those questions and then think around these solutions around them. And so actually part of what we did was because you see such differences in outcomes at the neighborhood level, right? So even places in Charlotte, certain neighborhoods, right, you have a similarly low-income family where those kids will grow up to earn around like $19,000 on average, which is extremely low. But again, similarly low-income families just a few miles away, those kids are earning upwards of $30,000, right? So differences in neighborhoods within communities are extremely important. But the question is, right, are people choosing to live in these places, or are they steered in certain directions because of barriers in the housing market?
And what are you discovering?
And so what we did was, because, you know, we don't necessarily know the answer to that question, but we did was, let's try something out. Like, let's just not admire the problem, but let's test a new solution. So our research team, we partnered with the housing authorities in Seattle and King County. And again, the idea was, right, are families living in certain places because of choice or because of barriers? So working with the experts at the housing authority saying, hey, what are the services that we can provide to families who are using housing choice vouchers, Section 8 vouchers, right? What are the services we can provide to make sure that they have the opportunity to move wherever they want, especially these neighborhoods where we see better outcomes for low-income kids? So these services, which included a housing counselor, right, an individual to actually help the family walk through the rental search process and help them identify units and higher opportunity places. We also engaged directly with landlords, right? So working with landlords to break down the stigma around families who use housing choice vouchers, but also to kind of work through the red tape, right? Because housing authorities, you do have to take extra steps to use your units with them. And then also using some financial assistance for things like rental applications, down payments, and security deposits. And so what we saw was that those families who received those services, they ended up being almost four times more likely to move to these high opportunity places, right? So really showing that it's not just people are choosing to live in a certain place, but these low-income families are facing very real barriers in the housing market.
Let's talk about these high opportunity places. I think that's a new term to a lot of people. It certainly was to me. Maybe I was unaware of the term and understood the concept, but I'm not sure I do, and maybe our listeners don't either. What you're saying, if I understand this correctly, is that there are people who live in low opportunity places. You see, these are the places that we identified in the first study, that if you were born poor in these neighborhoods, you were mm-hmm. likely to die poor because there was no opportunity to move up or to move out. At least they thought there was no opportunity to move out. And what the housing authority in Seattle is doing at your prodding is a pilot program that has identified these higher opportunity areas and then help the people who need that help understand that they exist and move them toward those areas. Is that right?
That's exactly right. And I think at its core, it's about empowering families. So it's not about a normative judgment of if a neighborhood is good or bad, but it's really just looking at the data, and especially for the most vulnerable families, right? Families where neighborhood has a really big impact. So it's not saying you should move here, you should move there, but we want to make sure that the choice you're making, because especially low-income families, housing instability is such a real issue that families are moving and are often very transient, saying when you're thinking about that next place you want to live, we want to make sure that you're making the most informed choice and that you're doing what's best on behalf of yourself and your children. So it's not saying that this is a good place, this is a bad place, but let's look at the data, right? Low-income kids, especially those vulnerable families, there are certain places where we see much higher rates of mobility. And I really think it's an issue of justice and fairness that those families using vouchers, low-income families, they should have the same choice that middle-income families have every single day.
So many questions about this. First of all, do you or your fellow researchers understand why certain areas are higher opportunity areas than others?
So this is, I think, almost the most important question, because kind of along with increasing access, it's how do we learn from these places that have higher rates of mobility to hopefully increase mobility everywhere, right? To make every neighborhood a higher mobility place. And so we see a few things. So we look at across the country, those neighborhoods that have those high rates of mobility, what are those characteristics that we see? And so there's four main things that we see across the country. One, there are places that have lower poverty rates, right? So places where you do have a healthier mix of incomes. Two is places that have good schools, especially schools that support low-income kids effectively. And then one thing we see, and I find really interesting, is places that have greater levels of social capital, right? So places where there's higher neighborhood cohesion, where you actually see people building strong relationships across race and class. And I think one thing that I find especially fascinating is that we see, especially for black families, especially for young black men, in neighborhoods that have more black fathers present specifically, all the young black men tend to have better outcomes, regardless of if they had a father figure in their own personal household. So it really seems to be that, you know, places where you can see someone that you can relate to, right, that shows you pathways to a stable career, right, that being able to see that, being exposed to that, seems like it has, you know, not just anecdotal, but real impact that we can see in the long term.
That seems to be the case, if I understood your research correctly, for young boys, for black boys who have black fathers that they can look at as role models. It does not impact black girls.
No, that's exactly, correct? And I think that's what's so stark is that it is a real gendered phenomenon. And I think that's something that the data is also interesting because it can, right, neighborhoods have different impacts on different kinds of kids, right, based on race, based on gender. So I think not only thinking around access to different neighborhoods, but how when we're thinking around community nonprofits doing neighborhood work, that it's not just a one-size-fits-all approach, that place impacts different kids in different ways, and that we have to be really targeted in trying to kind of provide those supports.
We're talking about what you've been piloting in Seattle, but I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, that in Livian, which is our formerly Charlotte Housing Authority, also at your behest, is doing some of the things being piloted in Seattle. That's correct?
That's exactly right. No, so Fulton Meacham and his team and Livian, I mean, they've already been starting to pilot programs like this, and so we're working now directly with them to find ways to potentially expand these programs and learn some of the lessons that we saw in Seattle and King County. What's also exciting is we're working with the Away Home Endowment as well, right? That's providing shorter-term rental subsidies to similarly low-income families and also incorporating these same mobility counseling services.
So back to these opportunity, higher opportunity places. Your study, obviously, your atlas can help identify these because it not only sees where people who make more money live, you have the ability to trace a pattern of how they got there. Is that essentially what you're doing there? So you can look at historical situations with those individuals and see, yep, they went from making $10,000 a year to $30,000 a year over the course of 10 or 15 years. This makes this a higher opportunity zone, correct?
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. I think we're able to look at the childhood roots of mobility.
Mm-hmm. So what are the characteristics of the people that are being guided by these counselors at Livian here and in Seattle, we're using the same principles, to these higher opportunity zones? Is everybody a candidate for that, or only certain kinds of people a candidate for being helped toward those areas?
Yeah, so the program in Seattle and King County, it was available to anyone coming off the wait list and who is receiving a housing choice voucher, right? So these are typically low-income families, right? Some of these families were coming out of homelessness, but it's a broad range, right? Every race, but generally families who are low-income, but we focus specifically on also families that have young children, because again, what we see in the data is that the most impact is on the kids who grow up there, right? I think for the adults, you know, we see that they're more satisfied with these neighborhoods and they really want to stay in these higher opportunity places, but we don't see the same income gain from adults. Mm-hmm. But for kids, we see dramatic impact, right? I think we calculated that for the families in Seattle who move to these opportunity places, you know, those children who grow up there will basically earn $200,000 more over their lifetime because of that exposure to that place.
And it doesn't affect the parents that bit much because what opportunity has passed them by. They didn't have those role models when they were kids. Is that essentially it?
So I think in terms of the impact, right, you know, we see better health outcomes. We see kind of certain benefits, but we don't see that same income impact, right? We're not seeing the adults earn more because of that move, but we do see it for the kids.
So when we see, well, traditionally, I think when this city and other cities have seen problems in low-income areas, the instinct has been to go in and try to lift those areas up, improve the infrastructure, pump money into the area, give them opportunities like trying to find ways to solve food deserts and things like that. You're moving people out. You're trying to say that's a low opportunity area. We need to move you to this high opportunity area if you're interested in doing that. And if you're successful at any reasonable scale, what happens to those low opportunity areas? Do they become worse than they were before?
So I think both the place-based work and those investments, along with kind of these mobility services, really need to work in tandem, right? I think we're not just going to move everyone and fix the problem. We've looked at things like the Harlem Children's Zone, right, which had tremendous impacts on neighborhoods, right? We see that their schools and their work in some ways really closing the black-white achievement gap. But I think there's a lot of work to be done to figure out how we can scale programs like that in place. So I think it's not just about moving people out, but how we, again, kind of empower families, right? Because some families, right, maybe they want to stay in that neighborhood, right? You know, they have a really strong network of churches, their families there. And for them, that's the best place for them. Mm-hmm. Whereas other families, maybe they have, you know, a teenage son who they know needs to be like in the safest, most secure neighborhood out in the suburbs. And that's the best choice for them. But then really being able to then target these neighborhoods that have been disinvested in for decades. So I think these things really need to work together in tandem, because I think, right, if we're a nation or a community that is okay with having, you know, good neighborhoods and bad neighborhoods, poor neighborhoods and rich neighborhoods, I don't think we're ever going to solve the problem. So I think it's both how do we integrate our communities and invest in more effective and impactful ways.
So it's a double, it's a two-edged sword. You've got to do both things at once. You've got to help move people out into higher opportunity areas, which will give them the foundation for upward mobility. And then you've got to go back to the lower opportunity neighborhoods and help them become a higher opportunity neighborhood, essentially.
I think that's exactly right. I think it's learning from history, right? So when you look at things like redlining, it was both disinvesting in places and not letting certain families move to other places. So I think if we're going to combat that history, we have to try and reverse it in a comprehensive way by both investing in those places and creating more access.
Of course, it would seem to me that a higher opportunity neighborhood is going to be more expensive to live in, and that takes us back to the question of affordable housing, which is something we'll talk about when we come back. David Williams is with us. He's Policy Director of Opportunity Insights at Harvard University, the same people that did the Chetty study that told us we were 50th out of 50 in upward mobility, and we're focusing on some of the solutions that they have found using big data here and around the country. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAG. I'm Mike Collins. David Williams is our guest today, a Policy Director of Opportunity Insights at Harvard University, working with Charlotte in terms of these areas of town that were identified as the places where you could not move up in the social rankings and you could not move up in terms of economic opportunity. They've identified those places. Now they're looking for solutions. And one of the things that they've been piloting both here and in Seattle and probably other cases in the country is where caseworkers guide families through a housing search process that includes having those folks look in unfamiliar areas of town, areas that perhaps have been identified as places where upward mobility is easier and there's a track record of it. And then they work with landlords to break down the stigma of working with housing authorities, because you're still working with housing authorities and you're still working in many cases with providing people with vouchers for housing. How difficult is that for landlords in these more affluent areas to want to deal with this?
You know, I think there's always the fear of big government. You know, I worked in the mayor's office in Detroit, and I think, you know, we're working hard to make our processes better, but that's part of this program, right? It's both helping the families, but also making it more attractive for landlords. I was actually in Dallas last week, and there's a company, a for-profit company, who has made it their mission to purchase single-family homes in these higher opportunity areas and rent them to families with vouchers, right? And when I first spoke to them, I think it was around 6 months ago, they had purchased 5 homes. Now they have 60 homes, and they're hoping to have several hundred homes by the end of the year, right? So I think it's doable, right? Again, they're a for-profit company, and they're staying in the black and making a profit. So this is a program that can work. And I think, again, when you bring together the research, like thoughtful organizations like Enlivion, and you really organize the community around it, I think we can overcome some of those barriers that we've historically seen.
Is the stigma difficult to remove? Because we do have a lot of NIMBYism, not in my backyardism, in certain areas of all towns, I would think.
I think it is, but the research is helpful here as well. And this is a bit more anecdotal, but part of what we see is that when the folks doing the engagement with landlords have a conversation about the research and say, hey, this isn't just about a unit, but you can be a part of helping create more opportunity for this child, right? You can be part of the story of upward mobility for vulnerable families in your community. And I think that really resonates, right? I think, you know, there are concerns, there is the stigma, but when you can actually see in the data that, wow, this unit I'm renting, I'm not just going to make rent from, but I'm going to actually improve someone's life because of it. And there's data and science that backs that up. I think that's really compelling.
Does that always happen? I've read something, and maybe I read it incorrectly yesterday, but I read something that certainly identifying these opportunity zones where upward mobility is easier and more, and a lot of people have more success with it, is a good thing for particularly the young people, because it's the young people who are going to benefit, as you mentioned, with higher salaries later in life. But I think your atlas also shows that just because a lower income child is born in an area where they will be surrounded by people with more affluence doesn't mean that they will benefit. They might actually be cut off from that opportunity. Is that accurate, or did I misread that?
No, I think that's right. I think there's oftentimes the assumption that places that are just richer or places that are more expensive are better. That assumption is sometimes maybe correct, but that's why really looking at the outcomes of the kids who grow up there is so important, right? We don't just want to spend more to send people to richer places mm-hmm. if we won't have the real impact. So by being able to use our data to look at places that, you know, again, might be working class or might be somewhat low income, but actually have good outcomes, I think that's what we really care about, right? We care about those outcomes, and the data helps us look at those outcomes directly.
I know you're working with Charlotte on this, and Charlotte certainly has this affordable housing challenge that the mayor has gotten behind in the last several years, and she was successful in pushing through or encouraging voters to say yes to a bond to support more affordable housing. But the city has very few tools in its toolkit. We can't make any developer or any landlord do anything. They can't do it. It's against the law. So you really have to appeal to their sense of fairness and justice, and et cetera. But as you move people to these, or try to move people to these areas of town that are more friendly toward upward mobility, is it affordable? Are we going to have to spend more money to do that in terms of housing vouchers? Or is there enough stock? Can we maintain or increase the supply of affordable housing in those areas that you want to move people to for the economic opportunity they provide?
So in the short term, I think we have the resources and the ability to do it, right? I think these places, you know, oftentimes they are a bit more expensive, but again, the research and data can help us pinpoint those places that are kind of relatively affordable but still have high opportunities. I think we can, you know, use the data we have to pinpoint those units that are available and affordable. And I think we can kind of start by, you know, having these pilot programs, right, to show that these concepts don't just work in Seattle, but can work in a place like Charlotte that obviously looks very different. But in the long term, and I think what's so heartening about what's happening in Charlotte is that we will need more resources, right? I think if we really want to scale up programs like this, we will need more affordable housing stock. We will need more available units. And I think, you know, you see the planning department looking at kind of different issues of zoning. I think that affordable housing bond is a really fantastic first step. It's been actually matched by the private sector as well. Right. And so I think a lot of what kind of we work on is, especially using the research bases, you know, starting with these smaller pilot projects, showing they can actually work and they're successful, and then using that to build the case for those further investments that we need. One thing that I find really exciting is that, you know, this program in Seattle and King County, right, that helped several hundred families, which is a great first step. But there are a lot of families that don't even get access to these vouchers. But what we're seeing is that even before we finished that pilot project, Congress passed what's called the Mobility Demonstration Act, which is appropriating $50 million for more pilots just like it across the country. But then after the results of our project in Seattle came out, a new bill was introduced late last year that would create 500,000 new vouchers across the country, with additional resources for those mobility services as well. So I think we're already starting to see that when you try thoughtful pilots, when you build the evidence base, that can really drive that larger systemic change, which can really transform our communities.
Let's go back to something you talked about a few minutes ago in the last section, in terms of how younger people, children, benefit from these moves to higher opportunity areas of town, because these consequences evidently can be enormous. You report that the lifetime benefit of a newborn to a newborn child of moving from a low to a higher opportunity neighborhood is about $210,000 in additional income, or an 8.1% increase in lifetime earnings. And when you scale that up, it seems to me, when you do that to lots of people, you're moving them and giving them more opportunity, it sounds like an enormous economic benefit to the community at large. If you have more people making more money, they can buy more things, the economy thrives. Does this more than pay for itself in terms of what we have to outlay to get people into these areas, and eventually what it pays off in terms of people earning more? Does it pay for itself?
I think especially for a community, and I think especially for this kind of program where, right, we're already investing millions of dollars in vouchers locally, and the U.S. government is investing billions of dollars, right? So, you know, when you're able to kind of spend a few thousand dollars to help these moves, which then create hundreds of thousands of dollars to benefit down the line, right? Making a somewhat small adjustment to a program that we already have seems like a really great return on investment, right? We're already using these vouchers. We're already investing in affordable housing every year. Let's make sure that we're not just building new units or providing new units, but really making them a springboard for opportunity that I think, to your point, really creates benefits for the community at large.
So we have what I think your research describes as kind of a three-legged stool here, because it includes affordable housing, it includes social capital, which you've already referenced, and it includes higher education. In another study, Charlotte did very poorly in the area of social capital. We don't know each other very well, and we particularly don't know others like who are not like us very well. And that study came out before the Chetty study that you're a part of. Have we made any progress there? Does moving people to from low-performing areas to higher opportunity areas also improve social capital?
So we're working hard on questions just like that. So we don't know yet, right? But I think the fact that Charlotte has highlighted these questions, we should be trying things out, right? So when we're working on these moves, right, what are ways that we can be more open in our communities, right? What are ways that we can support these families moving into our communities? But also, what are ways that we can just in our churches, in our schools, how can we really start to create more relationships across lines of race and class? And I think, again, the work that League on Opportunity Task Force and Council have been doing to look at these issues is exciting for us, because, you know, that's how you learn, right? The research has to be based in things that are happening on the ground. And so we're trying to collaborate and use the data, but also learn from what's happening here.
We cannot be the only city that has this social capital problem. We cannot be the only city where people not like each other don't know each other, because it's human nature to coagulate against, I guess, around people like yourself, because you're uncomfortable in foreign environments. So as you've done this research around the country, have you found ways to improve social capital that seem to work? And why is it important? Why is it? Let's answer that first question first, and then tell me if you found any solutions to it.
Yeah. So I think it is important, and I think it's something that, of course, you know, relationships, they seem to matter. But when you can see in the data that it has these longer-term impacts, that has these concrete impacts, I think it kind of helps it rise to the surface of importance. And I think just intuitively, when you think around, you know, how you got your job or how you picked a school to go to, it's all about networks, right? And kind of thinking around, especially for low-income families, if they're thinking about college and career, you know, do they have a network that they can reach out to help figure out what's the pathway to that? And so I think kind of thinking concretely around how just relationships aren't just a good thing in and of themselves, but can actually drive better outcomes, I think can help us think through, right, like what kinds of social capital can actually drive better outcomes, right? What kinds of capital can help you get into a better school, or think around the job market more critically, or think around what neighborhood you might want to move to as well.
The other piece of this three-legged stool is higher education, and I know that you're using data to identify pathways through higher education by working with UNC Charlotte and Central Piedmont Community College to help facilitate those with less means through the education system. How are you doing that? What does that mean?
So similar to the research looking at the impact of neighborhoods, we have a similar line of research about schools. So we're able to look at schools across the country. We can see what proportion of their students come from low-income families, and for those students, how well they're doing several years after they graduate. And so you have a place like UNCC that has really good success rates for the low-income kids who go there. But, there aren't a whole lot of low-income kids who end up at UNCC, right? So how do we work with UNCC to help more kids get access to that school? A place like CPCC, right, has a much higher number of low-income students. How do we really provide those supports to help those students be even more successful after they graduate? And it's been kind of great to use the data. We're starting to work with them to figure out what are those pathways between places like CPCC and UNCC as well.
Yeah. Government can do certain things. They can't do everything. And doing certain things, I think, is part of our constitutional charter to provide for the general welfare. But Dennis emails an interesting question. With a minimum wage at $7, there will always be mobility problems. Private industry has to get involved in this too, doesn't it? You cannot have an upwardly mobile life on a minimum wage.
That's right. And I think we look at these national trends, and I think it is those two things coming together, right? How do we help build human capital early in life so that kids are more prepared for higher paying jobs? But we really need to think critically around, what any and all jobs are actually paying. And I think what is most important is thinking around what different levers we have, right? What can government do? What can nonprofits do? What can the private sector do? And so just, one thing in the housing space, working with Leon Opportunity and the Foundation for the Carolinas, actually starting to work with private landlords, right? And recruiting new landlords to really be a part of and contribute to this overall affordable housing policy.
And a lot of what we've been talking, we only have 2 minutes left, but a lot of what we've been talking about this morning is helping younger people, children, realize a better life when they become adults. This is going to take generations. How do we know that we're doing the right thing if it's going to take 20 years to pay off? And is it going to take 20 years to pay off?
This work isn't easy, right? When we think around changing or breaking the cycle of intergenerational poverty, right? Mm-hmm. It is generations, right? This doesn't just happen after a year or 2 years. It takes real time, real commitment, and dedication.
And how do you how do you keep your eye on a ball when government's doing this, but governments change every 2 to 4 years?
Yeah, no, I think that's what's really nice about the work in Charlotte is when you have kind of folks across philanthropy, private sector, and you have an organization like Leading on Opportunity that can help kind of play that central role, that can kind of have that long-term outlook and help coordinate across different organizations. I think it really is about playing across sectors and having that long-term view.
From what you've seen here in Seattle, other places around the country where you're involved in all of this, are you optimistic about being able to put a dent in this problem, move us in the right direction?
I think when I see the work that people do on the ground, whether it's Seattle or Detroit or Charlotte, the dedication is amazing. And when I see research and evidence be able to drive national policy change, it keeps me optimistic.
David Williams is Policy Director of Opportunity Insights at Harvard University, and he will be in town for a Habitat Humanity symposium on this topic on Tuesday, March 10th from 6 to 8 at the Halton Theater. Thanks for the hour. Appreciate it. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.